I'm Amy Hall, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. Welcome, Greg Kokel.
Good morning, Amy.
Glad you're here to answer these questions today.
You best me on so many of these, which is wonderful. I'm thrilled. So I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you, Greg. Let's start with a question from Marissa. How would you go about telling a Native Canadian or Native American about Jesus? This person believes in her tribe's gods and goddesses and has made her heritage as a Native Canadian into her entire identity and an idol.
Well, I don't have like a clever thing to say here, right? And this is the way to address these kind of people. But keep in mind that this is exactly what the early disciples faced in the entire pagan world. Everyone had completely adopted a certain pantheon of gods, and their lives were built around that. I'm thinking even in Thailand, you know, Thailand's a Buddhist country. I lived there for 7 months. But it's that's the official religion, but its visceral religion is animism, okay? That spirits guide and run everything, and so you have to appease the spirits. And one way, every house has got a little, it looks like a birdhouse, but it's not. It's a little house on a stake. Businesses have much more ornate ones, but they take food out there to feed the spirits because they've absconded with the spirit's land. And so to appease that spirit, they put a little house out there. And on the, like I said, it looks like a little birdhouse on a stake to appease the spirits. Okay, so these are people that are thick with beliefs themselves. I'm not exactly sure how to approach this. Here's the way. I'll give you a way that I approach this question with a lot of different religious views. If somebody tells me they're LDS or they're Muslim or any of the Jehovah's Witnesses, whatever these various views are, that they're deeply invested in for a variety of reasons. I ask them about their views, first off. So this is Columbo. I'm asking questions and I'm getting clarity on their views. Then after they share the view, I ask them this question. Do you think that your view is true? Okay, now that's going to stop most of them in their tracks, because for a lot of people, that's an odd way of asking it about religion. Do you think it's true? But you may need to clarify. I mean true the way gravity is true. Do you think that the beliefs that you have about God or religion or whatever are true in that way? And I don't know any other more clear way of putting it. You say true, capital tree, T, true, you could say objective truth, not subjective truth, but, you know, you cut through all of that by just saying true the way gravity is true, okay? If you don't believe in gravity, you're not going to float away. It is there doing what it does regardless of whether you believe. That's what I want to know, okay? So actually, the way I ask this is more like this. Do you believe it because it's true, or do you believe it because that's the way you've been raised?
That's okay. A great way to put it.
And then I let them answer. And if they say, well, this is the way I've been raised, I said, do you think it is a good idea to believe something that may not be true just because you were raised that way? Okay. And see what happens. It's hard to know what's going to happen next. Then you follow the lead. I want people to get the idea, to really genuinely think when it about spiritual matters, that this is a matter of the way the world is, not just a fantasy. If it's just a fantasy, think of your own fantasy. And why keep that fantasy, for that matter, just because you were raised in it? Well, I'm comfortable with this, my identity or whatever. All right, but what if it's not true? What if it's not true? There are lots of different views about God. You have one. They can't all be right. What if your view is not true? Maybe it is. But if your view is true, then mine isn't. Oh, that doesn't matter. Really? Why doesn't it matter? These views have consequences, don't they? Mine does. Heaven or hell, on my view. Yours has a different set of consequences. So I think those are a series of questions that will get you into a conversation. Is the fact that you're raised in a religion a good idea to believe in that religion as true now that you're adult? And if you think it's true, we're column two. How'd you come to that conclusion, kind of thing? Okay, I respect that. You think it's true. How would you know whether it's true or not? You believe it's true. What are your reasons for believing it's true? Wait them out and see what happens. Make sense?
Great. We think too much alike, Greg, because I was starting to write notes here and I was going in the same direction, although your questions are fantastic. Those are so simple and so clear. All I had here was you have to move the conversation to the nature of religion, and your questions do that. You need them to understand that we are making a claim about reality. And part of the reason why this is so important in this case is because if you just go in there and you start talking about how your religion is true, somebody who has made this part of their identity as a minority will interpret that as a power move, and they'll mm-hmm. interpret that as an oppressive power move. So you have to start with defining the nature of religion and the claim you're making. You are claiming that this is something that's true. As gravity is true for everyone, it's an aspect of reality. Mm-hmm. Just like you would try to find out where Los Angeles is and what it's like, we are trying to find out who God is and what he is like. Mm-hmm. You have to make that absolutely clear, or they will interpret it as some sort of an oppression.
Along that line, Amy, that's a great observation. Keep in mind the approach I suggested. Does at this point, there's no advancing of our point of view at all here. It is asking them about the legitimacy of their point of view in light of reality. That's what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Maybe that they have all these great ideas, and maybe you'd be interested in principle, it isn't like you're wrong, we're right, and here's why we're right and you're wrong. Suggests this power move that, at least to them, mm-hmm. that you're talking about. But if you're saying, tell me why you believe what you believe, and if you're just raised that way, do you believe everything your parents taught you, or have you made some decisions otherwise about some, well, what about this? And you don't have to offer an alternative yet. There is a time for that, and keep in mind, we're in a gardening mode here. So what we're doing is gardening and preparing the way for something else. But it doesn't mean that in that conversation, we are going to put the something else forward. If they're really, really tied to worldview, they will not consider something else unless they have good reason to doubt their own view. And this is what we're doing here. The stone in their shoe in this case is a line of thinking that provides them an opportunity to wonder whether they are on the right track or not.
Mm-hmm. And then once you establish the idea that religion is about reality, or it should be about reality, the next question I would ask them to move to the next step is something that I ask Mormons, because Mormons are very similar in the fact that their religion is very bound up with the culture and their families, and leaving that is terrifically hard for them. There's a whole level of peer pressure and relationships with people that would be in danger if they left their faith. So what I have asked Mormons in the past is, if you came to believe that something else was true other than your religion, would you follow the truth or would you follow your religion? And I've had Mormons say that they would follow their religion. However, I want to put that question in their minds because I want them to think about it.
Sure. I wonder, maybe a follow-up to that would be, I'd follow the religion, why?
Mm-hmm.
And then if they said, too much social pressure. So you know enough about, here, I'm just adding a role play here then. So I'm talking to the LDS. So you know enough about Jesus and Christianity to know about being faithful to God, to Jesus, putting your hand to the plow, all of that kind of stuff, right? And what you're saying is you would rather make your friends happy than Jesus happy and your family. Am I understanding you correctly? And if they said, well, I guess it does come down to that, then I've already said my piece. I'm not going to browbeat them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that does put things in perspective. That's great, Amy.
It's a good way to know if they're open to hearing more. Because mm-hmm. if they flat out say they will not consider it, then it's time to just let them think about the categories of religion and truth mm-hmm. and what, you know, and see what happens down the road. Because at that moment, you know they're not going to consider what you have to say.
Right.
But I also think there could be people who say they would go with the religion when maybe they wouldn't, just because they feel like they have to be loyal. And so you never know what's going on behind
Well, the especially scenes. If they don't think there's any truth to any of this. If they don't mm-hmm. think there's any truth, well, all it means, it's just a matter of what a person believes. And so they're going to shrug off, and they're just going to shrug off to the, in a sense, subjectivistic side. You know, it's not a matter of truth. It's a matter of finding something that's meaningful for you. And this is meaningful for me because the whole social structure of my community is built around it, and I have no reason to leave. But that's because they're not viewing it as gravity. They're viewing mm-hmm. it as socialization and, you know, a fantasy club.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Greg, let's take a question from Will Black. What's your position on people having cardiac arrests and using defibrillators to restart their hearts? Is it similar to your position on life support where it's not required to do?
No, it's not on life support. A lot depends on what you mean by life support. I mean, there are different versions of that. People who take insulin are on life support because if they didn't take it, they'd die. All right. You have other people that are dead by any by most. I'm trying to think of the best way to characterize this. But by standard medical definitions, their heart is not beating, and they have the flat EKG and EEG. Let's put it that way. They're flatlined. Okay, but it's possible to keep pumping their blood by machine and keep their tissues alive at least for a while. Okay, that's life support too, but the only thing that's alive are the tissues, not the human. All right? And so when you have somebody here's the parallel to the question. If I find somebody who's been drowned and I pull them out of the water, they're not breathing. Should I give them mouth to mouth and get them breathing again? Who would debate that? Of course you should. So there are plenty of means that we might take to restore, I'm trying to think of the word right now because I want to say restore life, but that kind of person isn't dead. That person is close to being dead. Is to restore health quickly and viability, whatever, by some means that we can use that is appropriate and, in fact, obligatory for us to do. And there's no parallel, it seems to me, with an extreme life support circumstance where it becomes appropriate to pull the plug, so to speak. If there's no requirement to stick the plug in, there's no requirement to keep the plug in, all right, is the way that ethic works. But if there's something that we can do to save the person, we're morally obliged to do so. And that would be, you know, giving CPR, or using the paddles, and the paddles are just another more aggressive form of CPR. All right. And that restores a person when it works right away. They're back in. They're back in play.
Greg, what do you think about people who are, let's say they are in a situation where they have a serious medical condition and they want to have a do not resuscitate. And maybe they're older, or maybe they have some deteriorating disease where it's terminal. And if they do have some sort of cardiac event, they request not to be revived. In that sense, what do you think in that case?
Well, there are two different issues here. One of them is a personal autonomy and DNR requests, okay, do not revive. A person has the right, this is a longstanding medical ethical practice, to deny care if they want to. My mother-in-law was early 90s, and she had a radical mastectomy. And Trova was on her feet doing her normal chores and everything, and she is a very hardy woman. Like 4 days after the mastectomy, maybe 3 days, unbelievable. And so then she had a reprieve for about 4 years. And then when she was 95, she had a recurrence. And then she said, I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to ride it out. And then she died when she was 96. So it was totally appropriate for her to say, okay, I'm ready to go. People can make that decision. Okay. That's just a general DNR kind of thing. The factors of this decision play together are you don't give care or life-saving care to someone unless there is a reasonable explanation of benefit. All right. So if a person is dying of cancer, they're terminal, and they go into cardiac arrest, there is no sense in restoring them when they are terminal in another sense very shortly. There's no benefit that comes from restoring that person from a full arrest. Now, keep in mind, we're not talking about quality of life concerns. Oh, there's no sense. He lost both his legs, so there's no sense. He's 23 years old, so if he has a cardiac arrest, let him go because he won't have a good life, presumably, some people might think. Well, that's a whole different kind of consideration. The response to the arrest, a successful response, does have reasonable expectation of benefit. It will save his life. Now, what's left of his life is a matter of personal decision, what he makes of it. But what we don't do is we don't make those things on mere quality of life considerations. Okay? By the way, this is what happened with Melinda. She went down, oh my goodness, we just had it in a certain sense an anniversary just a couple days ago, because I think it was December 2nd, about 4 years ago, when she had her accident, fell off her ladder, cracked her skull. And the doctor said, I had her advanced directive. I had the original. It was in my care. And so on my way to the hospital at UCLA, I'm driving in the freeway talking to the surgeon. Should we give her this surgery? It will save her life. If we don't give it, it won't save her life. Now, if we do save her life, then it's likely she will not be able to care for herself anymore. All right, now notice that this decision is a quality of life decision. We let her go, then she dies. If we save her, she won't have the quality of life that she had before. But can the operation save her life so that she has a life at whatever level it is? Of course it could. It did. And I knew this was Melinda's desire, and actually asked the doctor, too. And that was his sense too. If there was no reasonable expectation of benefit from this complicated surgery, then we wouldn't have gone through with it. But there was a reasonable expectation of benefit to accomplish what it was meant to accomplish, that save her life. Quality of life issues aside, unfortunately, now we're in a situation where quality of life issues are paramount. This is why there are in Iceland, they don't have any more Down syndrome children. Why? Because they kill them before they're born. In abortion. Amniocentesis is a search and destroy mission. They find him, they kill him. oh, we don't have any Down syndrome anymore. Not in our country. Isn't that wonderful? That's because you killed them all. In utero, but it doesn't change the moral equation. Okay. Why? Well, because they're making decisions about what they think is going to be an inappropriate quality of life that those children would lead. But of course, people who have Down syndrome, people who have connections with Down's children, know how satisfying a life they can lead. It's harder for the parents, sure. But many of those parents are deeply satisfied that they have children like this to care for and love. Anyway, that's kind of another topic, but I was just making the distinction that reasonable expectation of benefit has to do with the medical concern at hand and not with quality of life concerns.
So you're saying that when it comes to resuscitating someone after a cardiac event, if there's a reasonable expectation that this will save their life, then we should do it. If there's not a reasonable expectation that this will save their lives, for example, they have some other condition that's deteriorating or whatever it is, then it's
terminal, right?
Then it isn't wrong for them to say that they don't wish to be resuscitated.
Well, they can always say that under any circumstance. I just saw an article the other day that the guy said, I want to die at 70 is what he said, because that's I'll be dying in the prime of my life. So, okay, so I don't know. He could say, if I get a heart attack, I have a DNR, all right? Well, wait a minute. You could have another 20 years. No, I don't want those 20 years. I just want to die. Well, he could do that. Okay, so that's always on the autonomy side. The other side, though, where we have to make a decision is what do we decide regarding that if we're a decision maker? And this is where the reasonable expectation of benefit, and there's also an undue burden issue that comes in, but we don't need to go there right now. I think the illustrations we gave are adequate to clarify. You don't bring a person out of cardiac arrest to let them die of cancer a couple of weeks later. You know, if they're in a hospice, you just let them go. You know, so I think that's a morally acceptable way to handle this.
Well, thank you, Greg, for your thoughts on that. I think that was really helpful. And thank you, Marissa. Thank you, Will, for your questions. If you have a question, send it to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.